Accession number 33891.
Real one.
Squadron leader Gary Garrett, real one. Can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
I was born on the Isle of Dogs in 1922 in a pub called the Builder's Arms. But I moved out of it when I was about 2 months old and spent the rest of my growing up in the Prince of Wales in Acne, down the River Lee, if you know Acne or well. That's where I came from, you see, down there. And I stayed there until I joined the Air Force. But I suppose, really, growing up in that part of the world is in itself quite amazing, quite amazing. But I won't go into pub life unless you'd like me to. Well, I'll tell you a good funny story about pub life. My parents would be behind the counter one evening, and because there was nobody else upstairs other than me at about 9 or 10, I was sitting behind the counter until it was time to go to bed. And in front of me were two bargees who worked on the river. The pub was on the banks of the River Lee. And they were parents to my get part of my gang that I played with. And they called my father over and said, "Here, Ted, we're having an argument. He says there's 2 pints to a quart, and I says it's 4. What is it?" And my father said, "It's 2 pints to a quart." "Yeah, well, I see." I said so, and off my father went. They had 2 pint glasses in front of them, and they slowly emptied, and they called over a brand new barmaid. "Here, 2 pints, please, love." So she pulled up the pint, put down the... And I think she asked for something like 1 and 2 pence for 2 pints of beer. I'm not sure the amount. And the chap said, "It's all right, it's on the gov." And she said, "I beg, what do you mean?" And he yelled down to my father at the other end of the counter, "You did say 2 pints, didn't you, Ted?" And my father said, "Yeah, that's right, 2 pints. And the girl walked away. That was the sort of thing that happened. And there was another rather amusing story about growing up in that part of the world, which I think you will find hard to believe, but it's true. The back door of the pub opened onto the towpath of the River Lee. And the pub was actually situated on the crossroads, with north-south Lee Bridge Road, east-west the River Lee. So the river ran under the bridge right by the corner of the house. And me and my mates were playing on the towpath, and one of the boys said, hey, there's a body in the river. And one of them went rushing up to the pub to yell to the members in the public bar, "Body in the river." And on the back wall of my father's pub was a long pole about 12, 15 feet long, and had a grappling hook. And there was a life belt, all those sort of things you would throw around for saving people. And two of them came down, grabbed this pole and hooked the body, and stood there like that. And then I noticed two others running across the bridge, jumped over the wall into what was then the gardens of the Metropolitan Water Board, where there was another set of saving equipment. They grabbed the hook, hooked the body, my PR on my side let go, and they dragged it in onto the other side of the river. So I went to my father later on, "Here, Dad, what was that all about?" "Oh," he said, "over in Acne, the coroner's court pays 7 and 6 for recovering a body. In Leighton, they pay 10 bob. So that means 0.5 crown more, another 5 pints. But that's life. Anyway, back to the story of the war. And I suppose my war started when I was in the East End of London and the Blitz, because more excitement for me then than came later, because I had an easy war, as you will discover.
Can I ask about pub life, though, in that era? Because I assume it was much more vibrant than it is today.
Yes, it really was quite... for example, because most of our customers, public bar customers, were bargees, they would always come in every Saturday night with the family. And the pub was a long counter, one end deep enough to take the dartboard, and the other end was a piano, and the families would sit there, and you'd hear the same old Cockney songs week after week, "Nelly D," "My Old Man Said Follow the Van," and it was all good fun, and they really enjoyed themselves. But they had the heart of gold. I remember one evening, I was sitting listening to all this music again, and a young girl came in, and which was very unusual for a girl to come in on her own, and she sat down and had a port and lemon. I think it cost 2 pence for a port and lemon in those days. She had a second port and lemon, and I could hear the gang all mumbling, And then I realised they were one of them was taking bets. And they were betting on, A, was she going to go out and throw herself in the river? Was she going to undress before she did? Did she jump off the bridge? Would she go off the towpath? They were actually running a book on what this kid was going to do. And eventually this girl, after I think a third or fourth, went out. They gave her a few minutes. So some of the chaps went rushing across the road so they'd get on to the towpath on the other side to watch. A couple stood at the bottom of the bridge and watched. And I wasn't allowed to go and watch, but I'm told the moment she hit the water and started screaming, they threw the life belt and dragged her in. My mother supplied a complete set of clean clothes, dry clothes for her, and one of the wives took this girl under her arm and said, come on, love, we're going home, and took her home. And all the money that had been taken on the book was given to the girl. The bookie said, it's all yours, dear. That's the sort of way the Cockneys were. Well, they weren't true Cockneys. They all spoke with a Cockney accent. But as you know, to be a Cockney, you have to be sold in, born within the sound of Bow Bells. And Hackney is not within the sound of Bow Bells. But there were all sorts of other things like that. Each weekend, we'd have a cockle stall outside the bar, or a peat nut stall and things like that. And quite often, as a 9, 10, 11-year-old, I would serve behind it while the owner came in and had a drink. It was a good way to grow up. I learned a lot about life then, and I think it served me in purpose as I grew up.
And with your father, I imagine, as a publican, there was quite a standing in the community as a publican in those days.
Not really. Well, yes, but there were three pubs all within spitting distance of each other. So you had to play your cards right to keep the customers, and we obviously kept a lot of the bargees. No, I don't know that he was. I think he was liked. He was. I know when he eventually retired, he was very sorely missed. My brother-in-law took over for a little while in his place, and I gather it was not quite such a success. So, in fact, they say that I lived there all the time. Not quite true. For 2 years, we lived in a place called the Montrose, which was near the Caledonian Market. Brewers had asked him to take that over because it was running down, and they thought he. And we did 2 years there. That was quite amusing too, because from the roof of the pub, I could look and see Holloway Castle, Women's Prison, across the road from where I was standing, Pentonville Prison, and looking to the south, the Arsenal Football Stadium, so I could see a bit of London. And right up on the top, Alexandra Palace, where at a later stage I went and broke my right wrist coming off the skates, because they had a skating rink there. In fact, I got into trouble too, because I found that by having a mirror on the roof, I could flash a light along the cell windows of the Pentonville, and hands would come out waving hangers at me. And my father was asked to tell me to stop doing that. And the other interesting thing too, going to school, I would have to go along the road, down the Caledonian Road a bit, past the entrance to Pentonville Prison. And I can remember, I was at that school when I was between 11 and 13, I suppose, before we came back to the Prince of Wales. And I can remember on two occasions, the crowds outside the gate waiting to see the notice to come up, the hanging had been completed. Great life. So, but does say, after a couple of years, he was asked to go back to the Prince of Wales. Incidentally, it is now called the Princess of Wales. I gather the brewers did not approve of the way Diana was treated. And they changed the name to the Princess of Wales. I visited it a couple of years ago, and it hasn't changed much. Anyway, as I say, during the war, the Blitz, I got involved fairly early on, because at the age of 18, I joined the Acme Home Guard. And I think I can claim to be the youngest sergeant in the Home Guard. In those days, kids left school normally when they were 14. I'd gone to a school where you had finished at 16, and during the last 2 years had done what they call a commercial course, where you learn to type, do shorthand, bookkeeping and things like that. And I'd got a job as an office boy on a stock jobber's office. London stock jobbers, you know the difference between jobber and a broker. And the stock broker sells to the public. The stock jobber is the wholesaler who deals between the stock brokers. And I had a job with the staff. Anyway, I walked up, the Home Guard had only just started, there was a cure, Bods, and a character behind the counter who was to be our Captain Mainwaring in due course. And although he was a nice chap. Name to the chap, Brian, what you do? I'm a stoker down at Gasworks, reserved occupation. Yes, mate, sign. Next one. Got down to me, he said, name? I said, Garrett. He said, what do you do? I said, I'm a junior clerk on the stock exchange. As I say, I was an office boy, actually. He said, yes, but what do you do? So I said, bookkeeping, filing, typing, general admin in the office. And he lifted up the flap and said, come in, Sergeant, you're in charge of this office. So for a year before I joined the Air Force, I was the sergeant in the office. But I was also the runner. I used to have to cycle round to the fire brigade, to the police with messages and things like that.
Can I ask, have you any memories of the actual declaration of war on the 3rd of September?
Yes, I was in my uncle. My father had five brothers and one sister. Every one of them had a pub in the East End of London. There was two in the Mile End Road, there was one at the Castle, there was one at Aldgate East. And anyway, I was visiting one of them, the New Globe in Mile End Road, when I was at lunch when the war was declared. And I was then 17, if 39. It didn't mean much to me at the time, but I gradually realised that it meant an awful bloody lot. I can remember that, but it's strange now, having me ask, I can almost hear that radio broadcast clearly. There you are. Anyway, for as far as I'm concerned, the Home Guard was a bit of a lifesaver in a way, and it gave me a fair amount of excitement. Firstly, they taught me how to put out incendiary bombs. I don't know whether you know this, but during the war, when it first started, the Blitz, incendiary bombs were dropped. And the way to attack them, or defend yourself from them, was to pour a bucket of sand over them or drop a sandbag to deprive them of air. And that would put them out, they wouldn't spread. And I think the Germans must have got wary of this and started putting explosives in some of them. So the Home Guard, we were trained to, if we went to put out a fire and a bomb, hold it, the sack, across your shoulders so your chest and face were protected, and then drop it on. And I approached one and it exploded, and I got 20 pieces of shrapnel in my legs, very tiny pieces, most of which were picked out in the first aid post in the building, and the rest in the local hospital a couple of days later. But before that, I had a very exciting time. I was 18 years old. I came home from the Home Guard, and outside the pub was a police box, and I always used to stop and say good evening to the cop who was on duty, because there was always one in the box all right through the war. And we were chatting away, and the phone rang, and he said, "Oh, anyway, there's a member of the Home Guard here, you tell him." So I picked up the phone. I was advised that the keeper, the signalman on the line that ran across the marshes, had heard a funny noise, and he looked up and seen a parachute going across, and he thought it was a parachutist landing. I have to explain a little. I said the pub was on the crossroads. Diagonally from the pub, across the bridge, was the Lee Marshes, called marshes, but only when the river flooded. And at the far end, about a mile from where we were, no, not quite a mile, the railway went across. And I was instructed to go to the signalman, find out what happened and see if I could find anything and try and follow the track of the parachute. Now remember, I'm 18, I've got a rifle, but no ammunition because I wasn't allowed to. I hadn't been on the rifle range by then. So I walked along the river bank, pitch dark, got to the embankment, climbed up it, walked along the railway line, saw the signalman who showed me roughly the direction he'd seen the chute floating. That was about a mile across the marshes, and then you hit the Lee Bridge Road back way I'd come. So there was I, walking across the marshes, holding my rifle at the ready, just in case, and I suddenly heard a voice shout, "Halt! Who goes there?" And I stopped, and it was the Leighton Home Guard, who'd also come down, coming towards me. So I said, "Thank God for that." But we found out later, rumour had it anyway, that the thing that the chap had seen was a mine being dropped on a parachute, and it was hanging up in a tree on the other side of the Metropolitan Waterfall. But I think the most amusing thing about that part of the, well, amusing, interesting thing about that time of the Blitz was the fact that my father's pub never closed. It was like the theatre in London where they boasted, we never closed.
Oh, the Windmill.
The Windmill. But he never closed, except on one occasion, and that was my fault. Barges used to come up the river, 90 ton at a time, usually with towed by a pulled along by a horse. Sometimes there'd be a two or three in a line pulled by a tug, but more often than a horse. And if they were flying a red flag in those days, it meant they were carrying dynamite upriver to Waltham, where there was an ammo factory. And I was on the bank when I saw this barge arriving, and the alarm started. And I saw the barge go under the bridge, and he stopped. The bargee and the drayman got off, back came out, got on the back of the horse, and trotted away down the towpath, leaving the this 90 tons of dynamite just outside the house. And I stupidly went and told my father in a loud voice, and the pub evacuated. That was the only time he had closed up. So, that went on for a little while.
Did you have any sort of air raid facilities in the pub?
Well, in a way, yes, and in a way, no. We had a cellar. Now, the barges going past the house, many of them were carrying timber upriver to a very large timber works, and many of the bargees who operated these are also our customers. And strangely enough, some of these barges seemed to lose a few rather large pieces of wood as they went past the pub. And my father happened to be there at the time. And being a good DIY man, he converted the cellar into an underground shelter. Now, the only thing that worried me was that that shelter was about 5 yards from the river and below the river level. And if anything hit there, the lot would be flooded out and they'd all drown. So I never went down there. I refused to go. But my family and my grandparents, who lived in right in the middle of East End, moved in with us for safety, and they used to sleep down there. But that was the only air raid shelter where I once took all my gang down to show them what went on down in the cellar. And the first time in my life I was as drunk as a newt, and I've never drunk beer since. I can't stand it. Anyway, I think enough of being growing up in the East End of London, unless you have any specific questions.
Well, I was going to ask you, with the Home Guard, what was the kind of commitment that you had to give to the Home Guard?
Nothing. You just signed, and there were no swearing in, as I recall. You just got on and did what you were asked to do by the boss men.
Was it mainly evenings, though, and
oh, yes, I went to... I used to go to work sometimes in uniform, which horrified some of the other members of this company who were also in their local Home Guard and were corporals, maybe, and I was a senior man. I was the office boy sergeant with the senior staff below me. You usually didn't go in uniform. It was just the odd occasion when the timing was such. Because I used to cycle from my home in Hackney to the city rather than go by bus, because I was only being paid 12 and 6 a week, and a lot of it would have gone on bus fares. So. And the thing is, the rule was, when it first started, that you had to wear grey trousers, a grey or black jacket, white shirt and a grey tie. That's what you were told to start with, but it all changed as the war got on. So, I joined, that was the beginning of my active life.
Can I ask a little bit more about any more of the, you know, what the Blitz was like in the area?
In that particular area, not too bad, because although we had the Metropolitan Water Board directly opposite us, and we had an electricity power station down the river, in the main, we were discovered by a lot of fields. We had the Hackney Marshes, the Lee Marshes. There was the Greyhound Stadium, where Clapton Orient used to play until they got posh and moved across the river and became Leighton Orient. You see, you know, that 2 and 6 difference between the bodies made the difference. And so there was an awful lot of greenery around us. And most of our customers walked across these fields to come to us. And they were, you know, they were... My father must have had something. Maybe it was the free cheese and biscuits he put out every Sunday lunchtime. I don't know. But anyway. No, the Blitz for us was fairly quiet.
Can you tell me about that incident, obviously, though, with the incendiary bomb?
Well, that actually happened in the offices where I was working. If you can picture a city office, tall buildings with what I would call light vents, so that there was a shaft, maybe the width of half a room, so that light could get down and mirrors outside. And a couple of incendiary bombs had come down during a daylight raid. And I was there, I wasn't in uniform at the time, I was in clothes. Unfortunately, the owners of the, or the management of the office block had realised the possibility and had put a whole series of sandbags there. And I grabbed one, went for it. My fellow clerk tried the same and didn't do what I was doing and got some of the bullets, some of the pits in his face, but not too badly. But that all happened in the City of London. We were just off London Wall. And no, that part of the world was knocked out quite considerably. And if right, for an amusing story about the war that comes to mind, one of my walks would take me round the back of the Bank of England. And the back of the Bank of England, if you've ever been along there, is a solid brick wall. No windows at all. And the area wardens had built an AIRP post, as they called it, of sandbags against, so that when the raid started, they could hide in there. And on the door above their entrance, there was a notice which said, built with a sound financial backing, the back wall being the Bank of England. Another amusing one, I used to go and visit my sister who lived in Edgware, and that required going on the Underground Railway, which I had quite a way to go to get on that. And when the underground trains went out into the open, there was the chance of their bottom tops, a lot of broken glass. All the windows were covered with a netting, which was stuck on the windows. And in the middle there was a little diamond, and there was a... Billy Brown of London Town was the sort of thing where it passed out, keep your mouth shut. Billy Brown of London Town says... And there was one of these that says, a sort of picture of Billy Brown and the diamond, and there's a picture of somebody peeling this stuff off the window. And the notice said, I hope you'll pardon our correction. This stuff is here for your protection. And somebody had written underneath, I hope you'll pardon my frustration. I can't see the bloody station. The English sense of humour during the war was quite something, all sorts of things like that. The lady who got on the bus with me one day went number 38, which ran to Piccadilly. And somebody going alongside said, are you going to Hackney? Mate? Yeah, Hackney, next couple of stops, we got Hackney. And then this woman said, it's Hackney, dear, not Hackney. That's all right, love, we'll pick it up at the Angel. Sense of humour. Right, shall we get on to joining the Air Force?
Well, I was just going to ask as well about rationing and things, because obviously that was a big part of life at that stage, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, we all suffered from that. Before the war, my parents supplied cooked meals in what was the part of the saloon bar. The saloon bar served the same drinks as the public bar, but it was a penny a glass extra in the saloon bar. You had the better people class there. And, of course, that sort of thing came to a halt. And I think he also had to pack up giving biscuits and cheese for Sunday. He used to put little squares of cut-up cheese in. So, yes, we suffer from rationing. But
Was beer rationed at all?
Hmm?
Was beer rationed at all?
No. No. We know. Oh, yes. Sorry, it did. Yes, definitely was. Because I remember on one occasion, my mind had slipped there. I remember on one occasion, the regulars were there. My father pointed out that there was only one barrel left, a nine-gallon barrel, I think it was, and between them they emptied it. But Whitbreads, who were the suppliers, kept out a fairly good. I don't remember my father ever not being able to open because of lack of beer. We always had a little something, bottles and whiskers, all of which, of course, were rationed, but... You wouldn't know it. I don't know how it was done. I mean, the most regular customers were the policemen who manned this box I was telling you about. Pre-war, this is. In those days, the pub had to shop at 10, sharp. And it was last orders at 10 to 10, and at 10 o'clock you had to be. To make sure everybody was out by 10, it was always a bit difficult. But we had an easy task because the pot barman, that was the chap who collected the glasses and helped behind the bar, would take 2 pints of beer, go down the side of the pub to the towpath, and on the girders of the bridge, put the 2 pints. So the police who came on duty at 10 o'clock, which was the shift change, would go there and have a couple of drinks before they came to check that the pub was empty. It worked.
So I take it then that you volunteered for the Air Force?
Oh, yes. When I had this accident with the bomb, the incendiary bomb, I was in hospital then approaching, well, I was about 18 and three quarters, I suppose, and I thought, to hell with this, I'm going to join the Air Force. I didn't think for a moment I'd get accepted for pilot training. I'd left school at 16, so minimal education. And the thing I discovered that was required was a thing called a school certificate. Well, I mentioned earlier that I'd gone to Alexandra Palace and had broken my wrist, that was my right wrist. And going to school one day, I was getting on the bus just before final exams, and I fell and broke the other one. So I didn't sit final exams. So I never earned a school certificate. And when I was about to leave, I saw the headmaster, and he was saying, look, I will give you a letter confirming that you completed your education. And so when I volunteered for the RAF, they said, do you have a school certificate? I said, yes, the letter. Nobody ever asked to see it, and through the rest of my career, my school certificate was a letter signed by the headmaster.
Why the RAF?
Well, you know, the Spitfires and all, that's the whole thing. Everybody loved the Spitfire, although the Hurricanes did a better job and shot down more than the Spitfires, but that's neither here nor there. And, no, I just thought it would be a good idea, but I didn't expect to be accepted, but I thought I'd have a go. I thought if I could volunteer for that, at least I wouldn't be called up for the Army, which I hate walking, or the Navy, or go down the pits. The thought of being a Bevan boy filled me with horror. So I went along and I was accepted and went through the various tests, initial tests, and